Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 41, To the Ends of the Earth. Since the beginning of our little podcast, we've seen the Christian church grow and expand across the ancient world. So in this episode, we're going to take a look around, surveying Christianity in the various provinces of the Roman Empire. To help you follow along, I've updated the map page on the blog site, adding new maps of the Roman Empire at various time periods. I hope these will prove helpful in navigating our tour. We'll start first in the Greek-speaking East by beginning in the Holy Land. From there, we'll follow the general direction of the Apostle Paul's route, traveling from Judea slash Palestine to Arabia, and then up north into Syria and Phoenicia. Then we'll turn west to first Cyprus and then the various provinces of Anatolia, before crossing the Bosphorus into Europe, visiting the eastern Balkans, Greece, and the Greek islands, before crossing the Mediterranean over into Egypt and Libya. After our tour of the Greek part of the Christian world is done, we'll skip over to Rome, Italy, and its environs to kick off our tour of the Latin West. From there, we'll head south to North Africa, and then finally conclude our tour by looking at Christianity in the westernmost provinces of Gaul, Spain, and Britain. As some of you may have noticed, I have omitted discussion of Christianity outside the Roman Empire. Part of this is that we just recently covered Christianity in the Persian Empire, and there really isn't anything to add. Also, though descendants of Christian captives taken by the Gothic raiders during the 250s were living north of the frontier at this time, we lack much in the way of information about them. The purpose of our tour is to give ourselves both a refresher of the history of the early church in the different regions, and a picture of what Christianity in the various provinces looked like at the start of the 4th century. Some of this will no doubt be repetitive, but I think a nice retroversion of just how far the church has come will prove beneficial enough that you'll forgive repeating some of the history we've already covered. One of the great opportunities these non-linear episodes afford us is the chance to touch on topics that we were unable to fit into the narrative. Christianity originated in Jerusalem, in the province of Judea. Brought into the Roman orbit by Pompey the Great in 63 BC, Judea began as a proper Roman province in 680. Jerusalem itself was, of course, the holy city of ancient Judaism, the place where the temple stood and the high priest of Israel led the sacrificial cult to Yahweh. It had been the focal point of Israelite religion going back to the days of King David. The Christian church began in Jerusalem on Pentecost in May of 30 AD. Led initially by the apostles themselves, the earliest of all Christian communities was composed of Jewish Christians, and prior to the Second Jewish War, led by the family of Jesus, first by his brother James, who was martyred in 62. James was succeeded by his cousin Simeon bar Cleopas, who led the community to Pella to escape the First Jewish-Roman War. The subsequent destruction of the city severely reduced the Church of Jerusalem's stature in the burgeoning Christian world. Simeon, too, was martyred in 107, and the Hebrew Mother Church fades from the historical record with the Second Jewish-Roman War of Bar Kokhba. Hadrian refounded Jerusalem as the pagan Greek city of Aelia Capitolina, and after crushing Bar Kokhba, took extreme measures, banning Jews from entering Aelia, and effectively proscribing the Jewish religion. Judea was renamed Palestina, or Palestine, after the Philistines, the ancient enemies of Israel. Though his successor Antoninus would lift the harsher anti-Jewish laws Hadrian enacted, the damage done to the original Jewish Christian community of Judea was incalculable. After the war, the earliest of all Christian churches disappears from our records. The familial succession of James ended. Whether or not the remnants of the earliest Christian church survived as the Nazarene sect, known from later sources, is a question for another day. This then brings us to the second phase of the history of the Jerusalem church, the early Gentile Greek church of Aelia Capitolina. In the narrative, we've encountered two bishops of Aelia of note, the miracle-working Narcissus and his at first coadjutor bishop and then successor, Alexander of Cappadocia, the friend of Origen, founder of the Christian library in the city, and martyr under Decius. Aside from these two, there is an anti-Gnostic treatise entitled On the Origin of Evil by a certain Maximus, who is sometimes identified with one of Narcissus's predecessors. The only other bishop of the city we've encountered was Hymenaeus, who, although he has not left us any writings, was involved in the controversy over Paul of Samosata. Specifically, he was part of the Council of Antioch, which deposed him. Hadrian's construction of pagan temples affected not only Jewish holy sites, such as the temple to Jupiter Capitolinus, built on the Temple Mount itself, but also Christian ones. The Greekling emperor constructed a temple to the goddess Aphrodite over the area containing both Golgotha, or Calvary, the site of Jesus' crucifixion, and the rock-cut tombs nearby, of which Jesus' tomb was one. The two sites were part of a larger area, which was used as a quarry, a garden, and of course, a place for executing criminals. When Jesus was crucified, Jerusalem had only two walls, and so Calvary lay technically outside the city. A third wall was later added, encircling this area, and constituted part of the defenses of Jerusalem during the First Jewish-Roman War. Thus, while Jews had to contend with idols of both Hadrian and Jupiter on the Temple Mount, the statue of Hadrian was located on the very spot of the Holy of Holies itself, Christians living in Aelia had to contend with the cult of the ever-lustful and licentious goddess, Aphrodite slash Venus, above the location of the Lord's death, burial, and resurrection. Interestingly, the very tip of the prominent rock of Calvary slash Golgotha was still visible, and a statue of the goddess appears to have been placed atop it. Though perhaps not the exact location of the crucifixion, it must have nevertheless been greatly offensive to local Christians. Such instances were not limited to Jerusalem, even, as the Oak of Mamre near the city of Hebron, the place where God and two angels had appeared to Abraham and Sarah in the book of Genesis, was also the site of an active and prominent pagan cult. Things were not all bad for Christians vis-a-vis the pagans in the Holy Land, however. Eusebius records a story of how the Christian senator Asturius, who you may remember as the man who buried the relics of the soldier martyr Marinus in 261, was able to end the cult of Pan in the city of Caesarea Philippi, or Panias, located near Mount Hermon in Galilee. It was said that during a pagan festival, a sacrificial victim would be tossed into the springs near the source of the Jordan River. Every year, the victim would disappear entirely, and this was treated as a divine sign by the pagans. Asturius, passing by and taking pity on the deluded devotees of Pan, prayed to God to end the deception. Sure enough, the next sacrifice resurfaced to the water level, and the cult ended. Eusebius also records an interesting story about a bronze statue depicting Jesus' healing of the woman from Panias of her chronic hemorrhage. The statue depicted a woman kneeling down with hands outstretched like a supplicant to a handsome man robed in a double cloak who reached back to her. Eusebius himself had seen the statue with his own eyes when he visited the city, and was informed by the locals that the house the statue lay outside of was the actual home of the woman Jesus had healed. Furthermore, a healing herb sprouted from the ground beneath the statue and around the figure of the man. Though Eusebius claims the statue had been erected by the locals to honor Jesus, it may have originally been a statue of Hadrian or some other emperor, and only later reinterpreted in a Christian context. Returning to Jerusalem, Eusebius also records how the episcopal throne of James, the brother of Jesus, had been preserved by the Christians of the holy city, and was still being venerated in his own day. It's impossible to verify if the throne Eusebius saw was authentic, given the unlikelihood such a thing would have survived Jerusalem's destruction in 70 AD, and the somewhat questionable notion of James having a throne during his leadership of the city. Nevertheless, while pagan idols and temples were physically dominant in Palestine around 300, the local Christians at least had some physical remains of what they believed to be their history. As a result of Jerusalem's loss of preeminence following the Jewish Wars, the leadership of Christianity in Palestine shifted away from the Holy City and to the provincial capital, Caesarea Maritima. Caesarea had a long and diverse history as a settlement. It originated as Strato's Tower, a Phoenician port for the city of Sidon in the 4th century BC. It remained under local rule until the Hasmoneans captured it in 103 BC, only to reacquire its autonomy after Pompey's conquest of the East. Decades later, Augustus Caesar gave the city to his client king of Judea, Herod the Great. The settlement was a vital port for the Judean king, and in gratitude, Herod refounded Strato's Tower as a Roman city, Caesarea, named in honor of his imperial patron. Herod saw to it that Caesarea Maritima, so called because it was a maritime port, was a thoroughly Greco-Roman settlement, including a hippodrome, theater, pagan temples, and all the trappings that came with being a Roman city. Not long after Herod's death, Caesarea became the capital of Judea, after Augustus reorganized the client kingdom into a Roman province. From there on, the city continued to grow in size and importance by virtue of its imperial status. The composition of the city, both ethnically and religiously, reflected its multi-layered history. Semitic and Greco-Roman peoples and languages could be found there. In Eusebius's time, the city likely consisted of pagans, Jews, Samaritans, and Christians in near equal numbers. Caesarea had a highly competitive and active religious life. The earliest history of Christianity in Caesarea begins with the first Gentile Christian, Cornelius the centurion, baptized by the Apostle Peter himself. Luke also relates in the Acts of the Apostles the ministry of the Apostle Philip and his prophesying daughters in Caesarea. It was also at Caesarea that Paul stood before the governors Felix and Festus. Although we cannot be certain, there are reasons to think that Luke hints at tensions already developing between Caesarea and Jerusalem, a theme which shall recur in our podcast. Although Cornelius is traditionally identified as the city's first bishop, there is a complete gap in our historical knowledge of the Church of Caesarea until the end of the 2nd century. The first bishop of Caesarea we know for sure of is Theophilus, who presided over a council in the city, alongside Narcissus of Aelia Capitolina and other prominent neighboring bishops, concerning the Quartodeciman controversy, the early debate over the proper dating of Easter. Caesarea comes into greater focus with Origen. You'll remember how Origen befriended the local bishop Theoctistus, who, along with Alexander of Aelia Capitolina, ordained Origen a presbyter. After his fallout with Demetrius of Alexandria, Origen permanently moved to Caesarea, founding a library and academy which produced such great students as Firmilian of Cappadocia and Gregory the Wonderworker. Origen engaged greatly in the religious dialogue and competition of his new home city, both with pagans and especially Jewish rabbis, with whom the great scholar had a mixed, though often positive, relationship with. Christianity in Caesarea was, like in other major cities of the empire, composed of both Orthodox and heretical groups, including Alcesiites, Ebionites, and, of course, Gnostics. Persecution affected the Christians of Caesarea, as Eusebius records martyrs under both Decius and Valerian, as well as the soldier martyr Marinus, who died under the Macrianae usurpers. Origen himself, although he outlived the Decian persecution, was tortured so horribly he succumbed to his wounds only a few years later. The bishops of the city managed to not be martyred. Theoctistus was briefly succeeded by one Domnus, who was then succeeded by Eusebius' contemporary, Theotechnus, another student of Origen's academy, and the bishop who pastored the martyr Marinus. Theotechnus' tenure as bishop appears to have been a long one. It was under him that Eusebius' spiritual father, Pamphilus, was ordained a presbyter and continued the work of Origen's academy and library. According to a later source, the library of Caesarea contained 30,000 volumes in Pamphilus' day. Even if this is an exaggeration, it certainly attests to the magnitude of the Church of Caesarea's achievement. Pamphilus expanded the academy and library by establishing a proper scriptorium for the editing, copying, and preservation of Christian and classical literature. The presbyter was also very generous with the fruits of these labors, making copies of texts to any Christian, man or woman, who asked it of him. By the time the 4th century rolled around, the Church of Caesarea was busy and active as one of the premier centers of Christian bookmaking and learning. All this enhanced the city's status within the church, and a rivalry grew up between the Christian leaders of the city and those in Jerusalem. Should Caesarea, the provincial capital and academic center, be the first among the sees of Palestine? Or should Jerusalem / Aelia Capitolina, the birthplace of the faith and the holy city? When the narrative resumes, we shall see this tension between the two great cities play out. With that, we'll leave the province of Palestine. Christianity was certainly active in other places like Gaza, Scythopolis, and Galilee. There is even a, probably legendary, story about a Decian-era martyr named Conon from Isauria, who was a descendant of Jesus' family from Nazareth. Although we could discuss Christianity in more detail in these and other places in the Holy Land, I think our focus on Jerusalem and Caesarea is apt, as those cities have played, and will play, the most important roles in our narrative. Moving on, the next province we come to is Arabia. As you can see on the maps, Roman Arabia does not correspond to our modern understanding of Arabia, by which we typically mean the Arabian Peninsula. Rather, Roman Arabia consisted of roughly the area of modern-day Jordan, as well as parts of Israel, Palestine, and even the Sinai Peninsula. This is why, for instance, the Apostle Paul could state Mount Sinai, where God gave Moses the Ten Commandments, lay in Arabia. Roman Arabia also incorporated other locations familiar to us from the New Testament, such as the Decapolis and Nabatea. Way back in episode 3, we saw how after his conversion, Paul went to spend time with the Lord in Arabia, possibly venturing to Mount Sinai, as suggested by N.T. Wright, before returning to the city of Damascus, where he had to escape from the troops of the Nabatean king Aretas IV. The Nabatean Arabs controlled much of this region for some time, until Trajan officially annexed the area in 106 into his new province of Arabia. Roman administration was located north in the city of Bostra, modern-day Basra in Syria. Christianity in Roman Arabia has appeared a few times in our narrative. First is the Jerusalem church's move to Pella. Various early church councils in the East mention bishops from Arabia attending, either by name or in general, such as the Council of Antioch in 268. We saw how Origen had many contacts in Arabia. He was invited by the provincial governor early on in his career to discuss religion. The Arabian churches supported him during the controversies which flared up around his person and theology. So highly did the Romano-Arab Christians esteem Origen that they invited him to visit and intervene in internal disputes about heresy no less than 3 times. The local bishops even deferred to the Caesarian presbyter in theological matters. Origen corresponded with the Emperor Philip the Arab and his wife. Philip, of course, as you know, is famous to students of church history for the legend of him having been a Christian emperor. What this can probably tell us is that his home village in Roman Arabia, Shaba, which he refounded as Philippopolis, likely had a significant Christian presence. Dionysius of Alexandria reports of an Egyptian bishop who fled the Decian persecution with his wife into the mountains of Sinai, only to be killed by Saracen raiders. The Sinai region was not especially well policed or governed by the Romans, as they controlled it basically just for the economic access to the Red Sea. Aside from this, though, we possess little else in the way of information about early Christianity in Arabia. What we can see is that the Orthodox Christians of this province were closely connected to their brethren in Palestine. Heading north, we now come to Syria and Phoenicia. Syria and the nearby regions were also acquired by Rome during Pompey's conquest of the East. Syria and its capital, Antioch, were all that remained of the Seleucid kingdom when Pompey annexed it for Rome in 64 BC. Antioch was one of the largest and most important cities of the empire. After Rome and Alexandria, it was the 3rd most populous city in the Mediterranean. Built near the river Orontes some 3 centuries before Christ, Antioch was the provincial capital of Roman Syria and the base of operations for all Roman military activity in the East. In this capacity, Antioch often functioned as the capital of the eastern half of the Roman Empire, when emperors took up residence there to conduct their wars against the Parthians and Persians. Like Caesarea, but on a much larger scale, Antioch was a cosmopolitan and diverse city. It had one of the largest Jewish communities in the Hellenistic diaspora, pagan cults of all kinds, Olympian, Semitic, and even Egyptian deities were worshipped within the city. One of the most popular was the Temple of Apollo in the city's suburb of Daphne. Antioch was, of course, the place where Christians were first called Christians, where the Apostle Paul began his first missionary journey, and where he came into conflict with Peter over the Judaizing controversy. The Apostle Peter's ministry in the city caused him to be remembered as its first bishop. We have encountered several bishops of Antioch in our narrative, including the apostolic father and martyr Ignatius, the last of the classical apologists Theophilus, and the opponent of heresy Serapion. In the 3rd century, the bishop Babylas was martyred under Decius. His successors Domnus and then Demetrian dealt with the Novatian schism in the East. Demetrian himself may have been carried off to Persia in 253. His successor was, of course, the infamous Paul of Samosata, who we discussed at length. In the year 300, the disgraced former bishop's followers still remained faithful to the Samosatene and formed a separate Christian sect, dubbed the Paulians by the Orthodox. Antioch was also the home of 2 men we discuss just before the end of the narrative, Lucian, the theological scholar, and Dorotheus, the presbyter, appointed by Diocletian to run the purple dye factories. The role of Antioch as the springboard for the expansion of the gospel in the Greek-speaking world cannot be overstated. In 300 AD, its bishops have been, for quite some time now, acknowledged as having a kind of presiding authority over the bishops of Syria and the East. As far back as Ignatius, the bishop of Antioch referred to himself as Bishop of Syria. It was only natural that an apostolic church founded in such a politically important city would result in its bishops having a higher leadership role for the Christians of the wider region. The same situation existed, as we shall see, in the other two largest cities of the empire. Though the most prominent, Antioch was not the only city in Syria and Phoenicia which had a strong early Christian presence. Some of these cities' first Christians were likely the Hellenistic Jewish Christians persecuted out of Jerusalem in the earliest years of the church. Amongst the most prominent early Christian communities in Syria was Laodicea. We've mentioned the two Alexandrian friends, Eusebius and Anatolius, who served as successive bishops of the city. Anatolius was succeeded by a certain Stephen, known for his knowledge and classical education. However, the bishop later apostatized during the persecution at the start of the 4th century. Other prominent cities the gospel had spread to included Damascus and Emesa, home of the royal priesthood of the solar deity El Gabal. The Phoenician cities of Tyre and Berytus appear to have had Christian communities by 300. Tyre even had a large and prominent pre-Constantinian cathedral. Syria was also the source of much early Christian literature. The Gospel of Matthew very likely originated from the Church of Antioch itself. Literature like the 1st century Didache, the 2nd century Diatessaron of Tatian, as well as the possibly derivative Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, all likely originated in Syria. Indeed, Thomas Christianity, or Thomas traditions, were common in Syria, both among Gnostics as well as the Orthodox, who connected the apostle with the church in the East. In terms of physical remains, Syria is, of course, where Dura Europos lay. You may remember our brief discussion of the city back during our coverage of the Eastern Church after the Decian persecution. I plan to do a proper discussion of the Christian remains at Dura Europos in an upcoming episode, so we'll once again leave them here for now. Following Paul by departing to the sea from Antioch, we come to the island of Cyprus. Like in the Levant, the earliest Christians of Cyprus were Hellenistic Jewish Christians driven out from Jerusalem by the Judean persecution. The island was, of course, the home of the Apostle Barnabas, and the first place he and Paul visited together on Paul's first missionary journey. Here, Paul established his strategy of going to the provincial capital and major cities, in this case Paphos and Salamis, to begin evangelizing. It was also the place where the Roman governor, Sergius Paulus, expressed interest in Christianity, and where Paul had defeated the Jewish sorcerer, Elymas. Barnabas' connection to this island naturally gave rise to later legends about his life there. For later periods, we have little in the way of information, though, about the Church of Cyprus. However, by 300, it appears to have had a fairly substantial Christian population. Crossing the sea again with Paul, we finally come to the provinces of Anatolia. Anatolia, also known as Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, has played an incredibly vital role in our narrative so far, and will continue to do so once the narrative resumes. I remember watching a 60 Minutes special on Christianity in Turkey, and how, at one point, the interviewer stated that Christianity, quote, began in Turkey. Now, of course, that's not technically true, but it does capture the sheer importance of Anatolia for the history of the early church. We have returned to this land time and time again in our narrative, from the Apostle Paul to Gregory the Wonder Worker. Summarizing the entire history of early Christianity in Anatolia would then be too much ground to retread here, but it's certainly worth touching on a few things. The proconsular province of Asia, and its great cities like Ephesus and Smyrna, have made frequent appearances in our narrative. Asian Christianity existed both within a diverse religious environment and was itself quite diverse. Various pagan cults were highly prominent in Asia. These included, to name some, that of the great mother goddess, the Olympian king Zeus, whose great temple in Pergamon was probably referred to by the Book of Revelation as the throne of Satan, the Hypsisterians, or worshippers of the Most High God, a sort of strange Jewish pagan syncretism, as well as the imperial cult of the emperors, which caused the Christians no short amount of difficulty. Hellenistic Jews had, of course, long established themselves in the major cities and provided Paul with some of his earliest converts. Christianity itself in proconsular Asia had some rather distinctive features. It had a mixture of both Johannine and Pauline apostolic foundations. The Gospel of John, Letters of John, and Revelation likely all originated in or around the provincial capital of Ephesus. Whether the Apostle John or the prophet John the Presbyter, the more probable author of Revelation, the influence of the beloved disciple and his namesake was significant. Chiliasm, for instance, the belief that Christ would establish a physical kingdom on earth that would last for exactly 1,000 years, based on Revelation 20, was especially popular among Asian Christians, as seen in examples like Papias of Hierapolis and even Irenaeus of Lugdunum. The Gospel of John's charismatic theology of the Holy Spirit as the Helper, or in Greek, the Paraclete, was important among both Orthodox and heretics alike. The Montanist movement is, of course, the most prominent example of this. The tense relations between Jews and Christians was also a constant in the churches of Asia. The Gospel of John and Revelation exhibit both strong Jewish and anti-Jewish tendencies. It's clear the Jewish Christians of Asia very much saw themselves as the true Jews at the time Revelation was composed, the righteous remnant of Israel. The mutual hostility between the Christian and non-Christian Jews of Asia was fueled by the ever-present threat of persecution. As we saw in Smyrna, both in Polycarp's day and 100 years later in the martyrdom of Pionius under Decius, the non-Christian Jews were more than willing to collaborate with the pagans to persecute the followers of the Nazarene. The Jewish identity of many of the Asian Christians persisted for quite a while, as many scholars think figures such as Melito of Sardis, Polycrates of Ephesus, and perhaps even Polycarp were Jewish. This would certainly account for Melito's bitter hostility towards the Jews in his writings, echoing John's Gospel and its denunciations of the Jews. Another distinctive feature of Asian Christianity was its courtodecimen practice. Unlike most Christians elsewhere, the Asian churches always celebrated Easter on the 14th of Nisan in the Jewish calendar, regardless of what day it fell on, a practice which Irenaeus says Polycarp and others received from the Apostle John. The continued connection to the Jewish calendar and Passover is another example of the Jewish identity of the Asian churches. From our point of view, there is also another distinctive feature of Christianity in proconsular Asia, epigraphy. Large amounts of Christian Greek inscriptions, or epigraphy, survive to this day from the pre-Constantinian era, far more than any other area of the empire. An especially prominent one is the epitaph of Abericius Marcellus, probably the bishop of Hierapolis, not Hierapolis, but a different city in Asia. Isn't antiquity fun? Who was the recipient of the anonymous anti-Montanist source Eusebius used. The epitaph erected for the late bishop is written in his own voice, describing his journey from Rome to Nisibis in Mesopotamia, and how everywhere he traveled, he was always met by Christian hospitality. The other provinces of Anatolia were also booming with churches by the year 300. Indeed, some villages and small towns were actually composed entirely of Christians by that time, and others contained Christian majorities. Anatolia had had a multi-layered and diverse history. Various small Hellenistic kingdoms had emerged after Alexander the Great on top of earlier Greek colonies and native Anatolian settlements. Galatia, of course, was settled by the Celts from Gaul, modern-day France. Greek was, of course, still the lingua franca of Anatolia, which aided conversion to Christianity and interconnection between the churches. But local languages still existed, such as those of the Lyconians, as we saw in Paul's day. Pliny the Younger famously described Christianity in Bithynia, showing that even the countryside had many Christians. Also from the province of Bithynia and Pontus came the heresiarch Marcion, whose Christian father was not only the bishop of the key port city of Sinope, but owner of a shipbuilding business. The other provinces, such as Cappadocia, Lycia and Pamphylia, and Armenia Minor, also had sizable Christian populations by 300. The Catholic Christians in Pontus and Cappadocia in particular had much to thank their wonder-working Bishop Gregory for, whose legacy was dearly important to the later generations of Christians in that region, who viewed him as a sort of apostle. Cilicia was, of course, the home of the Apostle Paul, where he had spent much time after his conversion. This vital province and Paul's home city, the provincial capital Tarsus, were strategic locations as they guarded the pass through the mountains of Anatolia, the Cilician Gate, the entryway between Asia and Syria, which placed the Cilician Church on a good springboard point to expand the gospel from. Like in proconsular Asia, the other Anatolian provinces contained heretical and schismatic Christian groups as well, such as the Gnostics, Marcionites, Montanists, and later Novatians. Already in the late 1st century, the Johannine writings were combating the heretical Christology of Docetism. Crossing the Bosphorus, we now come to the Greek-speaking parts of the Balkans, or Thrace and Eastern Illyricum, as well as the Greek islands and, of course, Greece itself. Paul had established various churches in Eastern Illyricum, notably the capital of the province of Macedonia, Thessalonica, one of the major metropolises of the empire. Further south, Paul had gone to proconsular Achaia, the heartland of Greece, where he preached about the unknown god in the Areopagus of Athens, and was brought before the proconsul Gallio in the provincial capital of Corinth. Corinth and Athens have appeared multiple times in our story. Their churches and bishops held a high place of distinction among the Christians of the Peloponnese. They were also in frequent contact with the churches of the wider Mediterranean, as seen in Paul and Clement's letters, and the correspondence of Dionysius of Corinth. Classical Christian apologetics began with the apologists in Athens. Here, the biblical faith of Christianity was brought into direct contact with the source of Hellenism. Going all the way back to Paul's mission in Athens, the pagan philosophers would, like the conservative Senate in Rome, form one of the core groups of elites that consistently opposed Christianity well into late antiquity. We don't know much about Christianity in Thrace or the Greek islands before the end of the 3rd century, but enough evidence does remain to inform us Christians were present in the major settlements. Crossing Crossing the Mediterranean and heading south, we come to the provinces of Cyrenaica/Libya, and of course, the all-important breadbasket province of Egypt, and its capital, Alexandria, the second city of the Roman Empire. Ever since introducing the city into our narrative, Alexandria has played a massive role in our story. Again, it would be fruitless to discuss the entire history of the local church up till the 4th century. Alexandria was still home to thriving Jewish, pagan, and heretical communities as well. You'll remember how Valentinus and Basilides began their careers in the city. The cult of Serapis remained as popular as ever, and the local Jewish community was affluent and prominent. The Church of Alexandria existed in a lively, and at times violent, sea of religious and philosophical mixture. The Alexandrians were still prone to street violence, something which will become apparent when the narrative resumes. Catholic Christianity, tracing its roots to John Mark the Evangelist, was probably the minority early on, as Egypt was filled with Gnosticism. But as we saw in Origins Day, the bishops of Alexandria quickly embraced their roles as successors to St. Mark and Coptic Pope. By the year 300, the city's bishops were understood to have authority over the churches of Egypt and Libya, similar to the relationship between Antioch and the Syrian churches. The status of the Metropolitan Bishop of Alexandria, combined with the prestige of the catechetical school, made Alexandria the center of the Christian world for many early believers, both in and outside of Egypt. In addition to major Egyptian and Libyan cities like Alexandria and Ptolemais, from the letters of Dionysius and the early life of Antony, we can clearly see how Christianity had deeply penetrated the Coptic-speaking countryside. By the time of Diocletian, Coptic Christians constituted not just a very large, but also a very powerful minority in the most important province of the empire. Egypt is also one of those places that we often have unique and special information about, not just for Christianity, but for ancient history in general. The dry Egyptian sands have proved extremely helpful in preserving vast amounts of ancient papyrus literature. For example, our earliest papyri fragments of the New Testament and other Christian texts come from Egypt. We now leave the Greek East and head over to Rome, Italy, and its environs to begin our tour of the Latin West. Again, the Roman Church's history is also so recurring and constant in our narrative that it would be pointless to retell it all again here. For Rome, we are, like Egypt and Asia, uniquely helped by archaeology with the amount we can learn about early Christianity. One of the most famous examples of this are the catacombs, the underground cemeteries where Christians buried their dead. 60 ancient Christian catacombs, stretching hundreds of miles underground, have been excavated by archaeologists. Pagan Romans had earlier practiced cremation, but as the 1st and 2nd centuries rolled on, inhumation, burial, became more common. Christians were early adopters in this regard. The earliest cemeteries were personally owned and donated by local wealthy Christians. As time went on, the Church of Rome began to collectively own their cemeteries. The catacombs of Callistus were among the earliest and most prominent, named after the bishop whom the author of the Refutation of All Heresies conflicted with over modalism. Callistus himself, though he was involved in establishing the cemetery, was not buried there himself, but instead in the catacombs of Callipidio. However, many of his episcopal successors were buried in the cemetery of Callistus, particularly the catacomb later referred to as the Crypt of the Popes. Although the cemeteries were initially named after their wealthy donors, they eventually became named after martyrs, such as the catacombs of St. Sebastianus, St. Agnes, and St. Marcellinus and Peter. The practice of burying the dead was, of course, related to Christian beliefs about the afterlife. Cemeteries were a distinctively Christian feature. Though pagans did begin to practice inhumation, their tombs were private and restricted for the wealthy. The church's cemeteries, on the other hand, reflected the equality and solidarity of all believers. Whether rich or poor, the Christians of Rome and elsewhere were buried together. For the poor, who could not afford to give their loved ones or themselves a proper and marked grave, this was enormous and communicated to them and to all the Christian belief in the equality of believers before God, as well as the love Christians shared for one another. Even the word cemetery has a distinctively Christian origin. In Greek, koimeteria means a sleeping place, reflecting the Christian belief in the resurrection. Those who had died had fallen asleep in the Lord, only to be awakened again to eternal life. It's no wonder Valerian, in his persecution, targeted the cemeteries. A very prominent feature of the Roman catacombs is the art. Some of our earliest surviving Christian art comes from these underground cemeteries. Symbols were quite common. Listener Daisy asked about the Jesus fish symbol, or the ichthys. Ichthys is the Greek word for fish. Jesus, of course, had used the fish as a symbol for the harvest of souls in the Gospels, telling his fishermen disciples that they would become fishers of men. Early Christians used the word ichthys in their art as an acronym for Jesus Christos Theo Hios Soter, or in English, Jesus Christ, God's Son, the Savior. Scenes from the Bible were also depicted, especially from the Gospels. Jesus as the Good Shepherd with a lamb over his back, and Jesus as the miraculous healer are among the most common. The catacomb art also tends to portray Jesus as youthful. The Roman Christians also utilized pre-Christian imagery, such as that of Orpheus, and solar imagery from depictions of Apollo, reinterpreting and repurposing these for a Christian context. The Roman Church was renowned for its generosity, both in the city and beyond, as attested by Dionysius of Corinth's letter to Bishop Soter. Eusebius preserves a letter of Bishop Cornelius, giving us rare statistical information about the Church of Rome in the year 251. He reports that some 1,500 widows and poor persons received financial and material support from the Church. Cornelius's letter also tells us that during his time the Church had 46 presbyters, 7 deacons, and 7 subdeacons, 42 acolytes, or liturgical assistants, and 52 exorcists, readers, and doorkeepers. By the time of Diocletian, these numbers had almost certainly increased. The Roman Church is famous for its associations with Peter and Paul, ground that we don't need to retread here, except that it became common belief among Christians that the two apostles were martyred in Rome under Nero. The cult sites, or trophies of the apostolic martyrs, were located, at least as far back as the middle of the 2nd century, on the Vatican Hill for Peter and on the Ostian Way for Paul. During the Valerian persecution, Bishop Xystus II also formally dedicated a joint site to Peter and Paul on the Appian Way by the catacombs of St. Sebastianus. We'll finish our discussion of Rome by talking about its bishopric. Back during our coverage of the baptismal controversy between Stephen and Cyprian, we discussed at length what may be described as the early papacy. So I won't cover that ground again here, except to reiterate that as leaders of the Christians of the imperial capital and the site of Peter and Paul's martyrdoms, as well as tracing their apostolic succession back to Peter himself, the bishops of Rome were always going to be important. By the year 300, the bishops were understood to have presidency over the churches of Italy, similar to the situation in Alexandria and Antioch. However, despite its huge importance for later centuries, the monarchical episcopate was slow to develop in Rome prior to the later 2nd century. Listener David asked if this means Eusebius and other later church fathers read back anachronistically the existence of the monarchical episcopacy when describing the early Roman church. In a sense, this is true. The apostolic father Clement, for instance, hardly represents himself as a bishop in the way his contemporary Ignatius of Antioch did, or even in the way that James is depicted as the leader of the Jerusalem church. Scholars see early Roman Christianity as highly fractionalized, not especially well organized, and certainly no clearly hierarchical leader. However, the Roman church also had to speak to the other Christian communities with a unified voice. It is this role, the role of the presbyter whose job it was to represent the Roman Christians as a whole and correspond with other churches, that was the predecessor to the monarchical episcopate. This was the role of Clement in his letter to the Corinthians. So in a sense, although not quite bishops, there was a succession of sorts from the apostles of senior presbyters, a role that eventually grew into that of the Bishop of Rome. One final note on this subject. You may have noticed that I have avoided using the word Pope for the bishops of Rome. I have done so to avoid anachronism, as the term the Pope conjures up images from later periods. Pope, or papas in Greek, was a common unofficial designation for bishops by their congregations, although it became especially used for the bishops of Alexandria and Rome. The first Roman bishop referred to as papas in the historical record, as far as I can tell, is Marcellinus, who happened to be the bishop of Rome around 300 AD. Going forward, then, I think when useful, I'll start employing the term Pope for the bishops of Rome and Alexandria. If you really want to dive into the history of the popes of Rome, I once again recommend Stephen Guire's excellent History of the Papacy podcast. Stephen and I did a crossover interview some while back, and I think the episode will definitely whet your appetite for more of Stephen's content. Despite all the information we have on the Roman Church, there is a surprising dearth of information about wider Italian Christianity prior to the 4th century. Italy, as the heartland of the pagan empire with its strongly pagan aristocracy, would not be thoroughly Christianized until the end of the 4th century. Nevertheless, a decent number of bishoprics existed before Constantine. The Council of Rome in May 251, which sided with Cornelius over Novatian, was attended by 60 bishops. By 300, it seems there were at least 250 bishoprics in Italy, and likely many more. For the environs of Italy, by which I mean the islands of Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia, the frontier provinces north of the Alps, Raetia and Noricum, and the western Latin-speaking parts of Illyricum, Pannonia, and Dalmatia, we have little information. These places have appeared briefly in our narrative, the Christian confessors sent from Rome to the hellish mines of Sardinia, as well as the Latin commentator on Revelation, Victorinus of Patovium. While the Italian islands appear to have had bishoprics in the major cities before Constantine, probably by virtue of their closeness to Rome, Raetia, Noricum, and Western Illyricum were among the least Christian areas of the empire. There were, of course, Pannonian churches by 300, but their numbers were fairly small. Crossing south over the Mediterranean, we come to Roman Africa, the birthplace of Western Latin Christianity. Our stay here will be brief, however, as we've actually covered the African church pretty thoroughly in our discussions of Tertullian, Perpetua, and Cyprian. Bishops from Mauritania to Tripolitania attended Cyprian's councils of Carthage. By 300, Christianity had thoroughly penetrated not just the many cities of Roman Africa, but the countryside as well. The Numidian countryside in particular was heavily Christian by the time of Diocletian. Though we possess little in terms of material remains before the 4th century, we do know from texts such as the Acts of Cyprian and others that African churches owned property, such as sanctuaries and cemeteries. In a tone set by Tertullian and Cyprian, African Christianity had a highly austere attitude towards compromise with the pagan world. The cults of martyrs such as Perpetua and Felicitas were extremely popular. Such devotion to those slain by the pagan state further fueled this outlook of African Christianity on the classical world. Related to this devotion to the martyrs was the interest in prophecy. Both Tertullian and Perpetua could embrace Montanism while still being regarded as Catholic, in contrast to the ancient Greek churches, who quickly condemned the new prophecy. A generation later, Cyprian and other martyrs under Valerian experienced prophetic dreams and visions. Alongside these charismatic trends, the Africans were also amongst the most gifted thinkers of early Christianity. Starting with Tertullian, Africa had produced, and will continue to produce, Christian intellectuals of great caliber. Latin theologians skilled in law, rhetoric, and argument, who honed in their Roman training to elucidate and defend their faith from pagans, Jews, and even other Christians. When the narrative resumes, we will return to Roman Africa and see how, once again, in a time of hardship, the African church would produce new intellectual luminaries to meet the challenges facing the church in the age of Diocletian. For the Latin West before the 4th century, we are well informed about the city of Rome and the North African provinces. However, for the westernmost provinces of Gaul, Britain, and Spain, we are, by contrast, as in the case of Italy and its environs, significantly lacking in information. The Gallic churches first appeared in the 2nd century, when we discussed the pogrom of Lugdunum and the great bishop of the city, Irenaeus. Over half a century later, the Gallic churches re-entered our story with Cyprian's conflict with Stephen of Rome over the Novatianist bishop of Arles. The earliest Gallic churches were largely composed of Greek speakers from the East, especially Asia. In Irenaeus' day, the gospel had made little way in penetrating Latin-speaking Gallo-Roman society or the Celtic countryside. By 300, however, this had started to change, and Latin speakers were probably becoming the norm. Nevertheless, Christianity was largely confined to southern Gaul. Northern Gaul, by contrast, was practically devoid of Christian communities prior to Constantine. Spain, or Hispania in Latin, first appeared in our narrative in the mid-3rd century, when Cyprian was in conflict with Stephen of Rome over the disgraced bishops of Legio Astorica and Emerita Augusta, who had apostatized during the Decian persecution. You'll remember how the Spanish churches consecrated successors to these apostates. Cyprian's letter discussing this event mentions how the local congregation and bishops of the province, Hispania Tarraconensis, collectively ordained the new bishop of Legio Astorica, while other bishops wrote letters of commendation. The capital of the same province, Tarraco, was also the site of the martyrdom of Bishop Fructosus and his deacons under Valerian. The other bishopric Cyprian's letter dealt with was Emerita Augusta, capital of the southwestern province of Hispania Lusitania. It is clear from these brief appearances that the Spanish churches were interconnected, in regular contact with each other, and in contact with the wider Christian world. When the narrative resumes, we will discuss the Synod of Elvira, an early Christian council in Hispania Baetica, down in southern Spain, which represented 39 churches alone. By the year 300, churches existed in many other cities, from Cordova in the south to Caesarea Augusta, modern-day Zaragoza, in the north. The final province we shall touch on is Britain, or Britannia. Despite many later legends about the earliest Romano-British believers, Christianity in Britain before Constantine is almost completely invisible. Writers like Tertullian and Origen make general statements about Christians being in every province, including Britain, but offer nothing in terms of specifics. The one exception from our sources is Alban, the first British martyr. Although his death is sometimes dated to the Great Persecution of the early 4th century, Alban likely died under either Decius or Valerian, given that the Great Persecution in the West did not affect the Christians of Britain. We also know that a Gallic council in the early 4th century included among its attendees three British bishops, meaning that probably by 300, the Christians of Britain were numerous enough to have significant bishoprics. Nevertheless, it is clear Britain was also one of the least Christian areas of the empire at the time of Diocletian. Although truly accurate numbers are impossible to come by, a consensus seems to have grown up around the figure that about 10% of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire were Christian at the dawn of the 4th century. Looking back at our maps, we can draw some conclusions about the extent of Christianity in 300. The further west you went, the less likely you were to find Christians. Aside from Rome and North Africa and some regions of Spain and southern Gaul, the Western Empire contained significantly less Christians than the East. The East, by contrast, had entire villages and small towns that were Christian. The most Christian regions in the Greek East would have been the Levant, proconsular Asia, Egypt, Libya, and Achaia. Historian William Friend even goes so far as to argue that Christians constituted the majority of imperial subjects in the provinces of Asia, Africa, and Numidia. I'm a bit skeptical of this, but these areas were certainly heavily Christian by Diocletian's reign. On a different note, the least Christian areas of the empire included Britain, Gaul, Raetia and Noricum, and Western Illyricum. The last of these is most interesting. The Illyrian soldier emperors, who originated from this region, were staunchly traditional in their Roman worldview. They likely had little exposure to Christianity or contact with Christians in their native land. To men like Aurelian or Diocletian and his tetrarchs, Christianity probably looked and felt even more foreign than it would have to men from Antioch or Alexandria or even Athens. So that's it then. A complete walking tour of Christianity in the provinces of the Roman Empire up to around 300 AD. I hope that gives you a good picture of the physical distribution of the early church. This episode was certainly longer than our usual length, and I expect the rest will be of similar size. As a result, I will probably need to stick to the monthly schedule for these episodes in order to do justice to each topic. Next episode, we'll look at the early Christian Bible, their reception of the books of the Old and New Testaments, the development of the canon, how the scriptures were transmitted and read, and most importantly, how early Christians interpreted their sacred writings. As always, thank you for listening, and thank you so much to all of you who have sent me questions for these episodes. Please keep sending in your questions and requests by emailing me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, commenting on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, or commenting on the blog site, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.